It's Monday, March 1st, and it feels like we are really, really close. We start here. Millions more vaccine doses are about to start rolling out as soon as this morning.
And we're just in that waiting. It's like COVID purgatory.
So how close are we to finally having COVID-19 on the run? First came the nursing homes, then a sexual harassment accusation, then this.
Second accuser came forward with allegations against the governor.
It's tough to guide people through a crisis when you're in a political crisis. Is Andrew Cuomo's governorship collapsing? And it's a new era for the U.S. in the Middle East, or is it?
You can't act with impunity. Be careful.
From Syria to Iran to Saudi Arabia, what we're learning about the Biden doctrine. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. This weekend, when I walked around my neighborhood in Brooklyn, you could feel a different attitude coursing through the streets. For the first time in a long time, people seemed hopeful.
So what finally convinced you?
Well, other people have taken it. I'm in the medical field. A lot of my nurses' friends have taken it. And I see they ain't dropped it. Sorry.
And part of that was that about a mile away from my house, the federal government has set up a vaccination clinic. It's run by FEMA, it's staffed by members of the U.S. Air Force, and it's capable of giving 3,000 shots per day.
Now that you got it, you just hope that it works.
Almost unanimously, people who went in the early days of this agreed this has already been a huge success. Fast, professional, efficient in the way that you would expect from the U.S. military. One friend got the shot because she's pregnant. She texted me, now this is what it's supposed to look like when a first world country is dealing with a pandemic. This is all happening, of course, because Pfizer and Moderna have been steadily upping their supply of vaccine doses. President Biden said he wanted 100 million doses in his first 100 days. Well, right now, we're hitting close to 1.5 million shots per day. The math is looking decent.
The Food and Drug Administration has authorized use of a third vaccine against COVID, this one produced by Johnson & Johnson. Welcome news as we move into the second year of this pandemic.
Later today, you could see even more doses flying out of garages, because America now officially has a third vaccine in the mix. ABC's Ann Flaherty covers federal agencies. And Ann, can we start with this Johnson & Johnson vaccine? Because the FDA gave it that emergency use authorization on Saturday. What happens next?
Well, we also saw the CDC give their green light on this. They said it's in the public's best interest to take this vaccine, everybody who's 18 and up. So that means that these vaccines can start rolling out of facilities as early as today. We expect shots in arms possibly on Tuesday.
3.9 million doses of J&J's vaccine ready to ship out. 2.8 million of those to states and local jurisdictions. The rest to pharmacies, communities, and federally qualified health centers.
I think, Brad, the way to look at this J&J vaccine is, you know, this is the first one to roll off production lines and not go immediately to hospitals or nursing homes. We have those populations pretty much covered.
But for many seniors across the country, scoring an appointment is a battle of its own.
We feel like we're in the cracks of society. If we were in a nursing home or a retirement home, we probably would have gotten shots by now.
This is going to go to, you know, the 65 plus crowd and the people with comorbidities. So it's more of a, you know, the vaccine that will help expand the supply that we already have with Pfizer and Moderna. But I think we're going to see more appointments available at pharmacies, not right away. It's you know, like I said, it's going to be slow and steady at first. But I think over time, this is going to really help to build up that supply.
Yeah. When it comes to the overall vaccination effort, Anne, like how are we doing? And does this make sort of a significant impact?
So the J&J vaccine is not going to be rolling out in huge numbers. I think what we expect to see this week is about 800,000 doses going out to pharmacies across the United States. You know, when you divide that up across population, it's not going to make a significant difference. But I think you'll start to see some of the demand ease throughout the spring until we get to about June and July. When we get to June and July, that's when you start to see the numbers really, really climb.
Well, things are improving. And we're going from a mess we inherited to moving in the right direction at a significant speed. This is not a victory lap. Everything is not fixed. We have a long way to go.
In the meantime, this is a really tenuous place that we are in the pandemic because, you know, on the one hand, you have these vaccines rolling out. We're seeing nursing home deaths plummeting, essentially. The vaccines are working in those populations. But at the same time, we don't have the larger majority of Americans vaccinated, so the virus is still spreading wildly.
But wait, Anne, like, you're always so contrary, right? Like, in January, I remember being like, wow, Anne, this rollout sounds like a disaster, right? And you were like, well, you know, there are hiccups, but overall, like, it's going pretty well. Now everyone around me is feeling super optimistic, and you're like, actually, you guys, this is really dangerous. We're in dangerous territory right now.
Well, this is about expectations. I mean, when the vaccines first started to roll out, it had to go to very specific populations. It had to go to healthcare workers and the nursing homes.
So starting March 5th, if you're 60 and up in Colorado, you can schedule an appointment with your local pharmacy, your hospital.
Now you're starting to see it expand a little bit, and we're just in that waiting. It's like COVID purgatory, you know? It's like nothing really awful, but we're still not where we want to go. And the thing that's really alarming, and what we heard from health officials last week, was that progress has stalled.
So I want to be clear. Cases, hospital admissions, and deaths all remain very high.
You know, I think what Americans hear when they hear that the numbers are falling is, you know, they get excited. They think that the pandemic is coming to an end. But that's actually really far from reality. We were looking at numbers that were so high back in January. At 260,000 new cases a day was the seven-day average.
The most recent seven-day average of cases, approximately 66,350, is higher than the average I shared with you on Wednesday.
Now we've fallen down to about 60,000 to 70,000 when you spread that out across 7 days. So the numbers have fallen, but we're still high. So you compare that to where we were last summer, we're at about last summer's peak. I mean, we don't want to be there going into spring when restaurants are thinking about reopening. People want to get together. They want to, you know, see each other, vacation together.
We may be done with the virus, but clearly the virus is not done with us.
It does feel a little bit like the pandemic could go either way this spring before the vaccines have a chance to work.
All right. Anne Flaherty, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
If the GOP has been doing soul searching in the weeks after losing the White House, then losing control of the Senate, then losing control of the Capitol building itself as insurrectionists try to physically overturn our presidential election results, if all that provokes soul searching, well, this weekend, Orlando, Florida was the site of a conservative tent revival.
Well, thank you very much. And hello, CPAC. Do you miss me yet? Do you miss me?
Usually, the star of the CPAC gathering is not the guy who was just defeated, but President Trump showed he has still got a stranglehold on the GOP, not just in terms of tone and policy.
And that's why I'm announcing that I will be actively working to elect strong, tough, and smart Republican leaders.
But over the question of democracy itself.
So how the hell is it possible that we lost? It's not possible. I got more votes.
In fact, less than 2 months after his supporters stormed the Capitol looking to harm members of Congress, he called out his political enemies by name and told his supporters that the Supreme Court is to blame as well.
And the Supreme Court, again, didn't have the guts or the courage to do anything about it, and neither did other judges.
By the way, some conservative members of Congress had a choice to make here. They could either talk at CPAC, be part of the speaking schedule, or represent their constituents in D.C. Congress was still in session. Several of them told Congress they couldn't show up because of COVID and then hopped on planes to gather in Orlando.
Orlando is awesome! It's not as nice as Cancun.
But it's not just Republicans who are dealing with complicated feelings among constituents.
Now an avalanche of controversy surrounding New York Governor Cuomo, from investigations into why he didn't disclose the number of nursing home deaths from COVID, which he denies, to allegations from two politically active women of inappropriate and bullying behavior.
ABC Stephanie Ramos is in Albany, the capital of New York, right now. Stephanie, we were just talking a week ago about the concern over Cuomo and nursing home deaths during COVID, and somehow he's now facing an entirely different set of accusations on top of that.
Exactly, Brad. So this story has really picked up momentum in the last few days. A couple of months ago, we heard from a woman by the name of Lindsay Boylan. She accused the New York governor, Andrew Cuomo, of sexual harassment.
Former aide Lindsay Boylan claimed Cuomo tried to kiss her on the lips.
Look, I fought for and I believe a woman has the right to come forward and express her opinion and express issues and concerns that she has. But It's just not true.
But this past week, she elaborated on those claims.
Boylan alleges the governor would make physical comparisons to his ex-girlfriend, touch her inappropriately, and once suggested playing strip poker on a flight home from an event in October of 2017.
She started working in the state office back in 2015. She was promoted, but she eventually left in 2018. Calls for an independent investigation and for the governor to resign have increased after this second accuser came forward with allegations against the governor.
Charlotte Bennett had been working on the state's coronavirus response in June when, she told the New York Times, she was alone with Governor Cuomo in his office.
The 25-year-old claims Cuomo asked her numerous personal questions about her life that she interpreted as advances toward a sexual relationship.
And she told the Times that she immediately reported it to Cuomo's chief of staff. She told her parents. She told her friends. So basically, she has her claims documented in text messages that she showed the Times. So she says that she was transferred to another department to the other side of the Capitol, but that wasn't enough. She says she couldn't deal with that environment. So she eventually left Governor Cuomo's administration in November. Charlotte Bennett says that she decided to come forward with these allegations. She decided to make them public because she wanted to counter the way the governor, quote, wields his power. And that's what we've been hearing.
I unfortunately do not think that their stories are anomalies.
I just spoke with Senator Alessandra Biaggi, who was adamant that this has been the environment in the governor's administration for the last decade.
It's all indicative of just toxic and abusive use of power.
And she said she was proud of the women to have come forward and just had their voices heard about this.
Right, you got these state senators trying to figure out how they're going to handle this, particularly, I would think, the Democratic ones that have been very vocal about believing women. So, Stephanie, you got all these calls for these allegations to be investigated. The question becomes, who's going to do the investigation? And it sounded like, for a second, Andrew Cuomo was going to choose that person, what, himself?
Exactly. Even though the governor was calling for an independent review
on Saturday, his administration said it had selected a former federal judge, Barbara Jones, to lead an investigation into the claims.
State lawmakers and other critics criticized that move.
The concern lies with the fact that this review was arranged by the governor's team, and it was overseen by an individual who has a work history with his close associates like Steve Cohen.
That's where the New York State Attorney General steps in, saying my office needs to be the lead on this case in this investigation. And the state attorney general will then select a private lawyer to lead this independent review.
And just minutes ago, Governor Cuomo's office formally referred the case to New York Attorney General Letitia James, as she requested, enabling an investigation with subpoena power.
Bottom line is that an independent review will take place. It is now sitting with the New York State Attorney General's office. They will handle this review, and the governor is essentially apologizing.
I now understand that my interactions may have been insensitive or too personal, and that some of my comments, given my position, made others feel in ways I never intended.
He says most of his life he's spent at work and with colleagues, and that often turn into personal friends. So he says that at times while he's at work, he's been playful. He's made jokes that he thinks are funny. And at some point along the way, made some jokes that he says were misinterpreted.
He says he never inappropriately touched anybody and that he supports a full review.
But he also wanted to emphasize that he never inappropriately touched any of these women. But he did apologize in this fourth statement that was made on this issue.
I was going to say four statements from Cuomo's office in one day. That's usually a sign that you think, oh, no, I'm in a lot more trouble than maybe I was thinking 48 hours ago.
Exactly.
All right, Stephanie Ramos in Albany. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, it's easy to talk tough until the bombs start flying. The fallout from President Biden's actions in the Middle East after the break. This This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Mr. Prime Minister, it's good to see you, and I wish I could reciprocate the hospitality you gave me when I visited Ottawa as Vice President in 2016.
For all the tales about Scranton Joe from back in the day, the area in which President Biden is a true expert is foreign policy. That was his chief focus for years in the Senate. It was his main task in the Obama White House. And when Biden became president, he told foreign countries, you're going to see a return to normalcy starting right now. And his words, his tone, might be way different from his predecessor. But what are we seeing from his actions? Well, we now have something to use as a comparison.
Mr. President, what message were you sending to Iran with your first military action?
You can't act with impunity. Be careful.
A small strike targeting a militia that killed American contractors, a militia that was likely sponsored by Iran. Let's go to ABC's Connor Finnegan, who covers the State Department. Connor, what has been the reaction over the weekend to this airstrike?
Brad, U.S. troops in Iraq have actually been put on alert this weekend. The threat level has been raised for them, according to a U.S. defense official, because the U.S. is afraid of retaliatory action of some kind from these Iranian-backed Shiite militias.
You can see those burned-out bunks, the fire destroying the structures. The same Iranian-backed militias have launched rocket attacks against the U.S. embassy in Baghdad and the so-called green zone surrounding it.
Biden chose these targets for a very specific reason, though. He's trying to de-escalate and to avoid a cycle of retaliation with these groups. He struck in Syria, not in Iraq, which gives the Iraqi prime minister a little bit of cover politically at home.
An official telling ABC News that the retaliatory strikes by the U.S. could have resulted in a handful of casualties. The Pentagon spokesman saying that the strike was proportional.
And the operations only used two U.S. warplanes. Our Pentagon colleagues reported last week that this is sort of the least lethal option that Biden could go with. But what's interesting is that you still have members of Congress who are saying he's gone too far, and they're members of his own party.
I think the Biden action was appropriate pushback. Now, I wish the Biden team would have given Congress greater knowledge. We got a heads up about 15 minutes before the attack took place.
They say that he doesn't have the legal authority for strikes like these because they weren't in immediate self-defense. They're not pushing too hard, though. Again, I think in part because Biden chose a strike that was very
limited. The strikes were both necessary to address the threat and proportionate to the prior attacks.
You know, President Trump of fire and fury fame is the president who responded to similar threats in Iraq with the strike that killed Qasem Soleimani, the high-ranking Iranian general. And so I think what we're seeing here is Biden trying to send that firm message without risking escalation of some kind.
Hey, so, okay, Every time we're going to talk about anything to do in the Middle East, we're generally going to be talking about Iran because they run so much of the show, right? They have so much influence in so many different countries. The other country that we're probably also going to mention is Saudi Arabia, right? And this weekend, the U.S. government puts out its official report saying, yes, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, did order this brutal assassination of a journalist who works for an American publication. And President Biden's response is to what, Connor? Like, give him a pass?
Yeah, I mean, it's something of a pass, especially to lawmakers of both parties. The Biden administration is not going to sanction Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is really the de facto ruler in Saudi Arabia. We do not expect any further action by them against him or other officials, at least at this point in time. And that's causing them more problems.
President Biden said his team, as I said, is going to be announcing more actions tomorrow. Should he be doing more to target the Crown Prince personally?
He is reassessing our relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is an ally. And I don't think that the chapter is closed on the outcome of the disclosure of this report. That's my hope.
Politically in the U.S., Saudi Arabia is deeply unpopular with the U.S. public. And what I find so interesting is that as candidates for president, so many of these politicians attack the Saudis. Joe Biden said during the campaign that he would make the kingdom a pariah. But now that he's in office, he's taking a look at the hard geopolitics of the region. And at the end of the day, they don't want to rock the boat too much.
But Connor, what I'm hearing from you is that the Biden administration is saying, hey, we don't want to get into a hot war. We don't want to get in deeper in the Middle East because of a scary regime or because of these, you know, pesky human rights violations. It's just not worth it to us to go there. I'm sorry. Like, does that not sound kind of like Trumpism? Like, what is the Biden doctrine that you're seeing in the Middle East?
Brett, I think the important difference is that they say they are putting human rights back again at the center of U.S. foreign policy. And by taking this action, by inventing something they call the Khashoggi policy, they are doing that. They are taking some step to recalibrate, as they say, the relationship with Saudi Arabia.
We have introduced announced a new policy that will apply the State Department's ability to restrict and revoke visas to any individual believed to be involved in extraterritorial activities targeting perceived dissidents or journalists.
They're also moving to end the war in Yemen, which the Saudis have fought for 6 years now against the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels.
So we're reviewing these arms sales and we're making
And they're changing U.S. policy in terms of arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They say that they will no longer sell offensive weapons to the kingdom.
This is bigger than any one person. This recalibration goes to the policies that Saudi Arabia is pursuing and the actions it has taken.
I think at the end of the day, the Biden doctrine that we're seeing emerging is that they want out of the region. After 2 decades of U.S. involvement in so many of these countries, they want to pull back and they want to refocus attention elsewhere. But there's also that guiding principle that President Obama allegedly coined of don't do stupid stuff.
Yeah, so close to the same word he used, but yeah.
Exactly. So the question becomes, how do you do that? How do you get out of the region without leaving a mess behind?
To underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
And the problem is the region continually pulls U.S. presidents back in. There's the same question with Iran. How do you re-enter the nuclear deal with Iran when Iran continues to ramp up its nuclear program to try to create more leverage?
Fakhrizadeh's killing comes as concerns grow over Iran's uranium enrichment activity.
And I think at the end of the day, that's what they're struggling with Saudi Arabia. How do you change the relationship? How do you recalibrate it, again, in their words, without isolating Mohammed bin Salman, who will become the king at some point in time? How do you not drive him into the arms of China or Russia? Or how do you not isolate him and create this sort of mad king problem in the region?
All right, never stupid stuff coming from Connor Finnegan. Connor, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Brett.
Hey, everyone. I'm Joe Biden's husband.
And one last thing. One thing we have not talked a lot about yet in the Biden presidency is the other person in the White House named Biden.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the White House.
This weekend, when the Bidens surveyed storm damage in Texas, First Lady Jill Biden chatted with food bank volunteers and with local leaders as if she had known them forever, appearing comfortable, not just speaking on behalf of the family, but on behalf of the administration itself. So 40 days in, what kind of role is this first lady taking?
Dr. Jill Biden has a profession. She is an educator and she's going to continue teaching. But we, I think, can observe that she is very essential to the Biden presidency, that Joe Biden looks to her as, you know, first among equals. She is essential to him.
That's Julia Swag, an author who's now hosting a new podcast about a different first lady. And if we're talking about clout, perhaps the first lady who carried the most clout in modern history, Lady Bird Johnson, the wife of President Lyndon Johnson.
I think that it's accurate to say that she was one of the most important members of the Johnson administration. I mean, she wasn't an official cabinet member, but she had, you know, she was a political animal.
She says there are lots of different molds for first ladies. There are the rock stars, Jackie O, Michelle Obama, people who gain a ton of attention here and abroad. But that does not necessarily tell you who holds the most sway.
I was surprised when I read Michelle Obama's memoir that she said that Barack Obama only asked her to come to the Oval Office once during his entire 8 years in office, during working hours, and that was on the day of the Sandy Hook massacre. That suggests, and Michelle writes quite a lot about this kind of church and state work-life balance that they sought to achieve. The Johnsons, it was all a mush. There was no work-life balance. Everything was work.
We know about all this because Lady Bird Johnson, like Jill Biden, was an academic. Specifically, Johnson was a trained journalist and historian, and so she decided to make audio diaries of her time in the White House.
We can think of her as the first podcaster in the White House.
Today's poll has Lyndon down to 39, the lowest he's ever been. And my instinct tells me the only reaction to it should be to work harder.
This is a story about the 1960s, and Lady Bird had a first seat at some of the most critical, iconic, defining moments of that decade.
It all began so beautifully.
First with the JFK assassination.
I said, "Oh, Mrs. Kennedy, you know we never even wanted to be vice president. And now, dear God, it's come to this."
Then two other political assassinations, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
It was clear that nothing was the same and that we were in a sort of a state of suspension.
Moreover, this is the presidency that brought us the Vietnam War. And Lady Bird shares Lyndon Johnson's blinders about that.
The world is undergoing convulsions all around us. Our party, our country, the whole world.
Today is the start of Women's History Month. What Lady Bird Johnson gave us are 132 hours of history, firsthand accounts of America at a crossroads, and a portrait of what it's like to shape your own path in one of the most undefined jobs in the nation. If you think that sound was interesting, just wait until you hear this podcast. It is dropping as I speak. It's called In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. It's a co-production from Best Case Studios and ABC Audio. It's going to be 8 episodes. You can get the first 2 episodes starting right now. In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. You can search for it wherever you listen. It'll be there. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.